Please join me in a warm Detroit Economic Club welcome for Governor Lael Bernard.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be here in Detroit, and I want to thank Steve Gregorian and Rich Schwabauer for a really warm welcome, and to the Detroit Economic Club for hosting me today. I had the pleasure of meeting with students from a variety of local high schools and Wayne Community College earlier today, and the future of our nation looks bright. I started my career here in the Motor City, and I have followed the fortunes of this area with great interest ever since. A few years ago, I visited some of Detroit's neighborhoods, along with some of the Federal Reserve employees from the Detroit branch, when damage from the crisis was still quite pervasive. And while today challenges remain in many of the city's neighborhoods, it's good to see that the metropolitan area overall has seen signs of a rebound in business activity and investment, and the unemployment rate has come down quite substantially. And of course, that's similar to the nation's economy overall. While challenges remain for many, aggregate growth is strong, and the economy is meeting our full employment and inflation objectives. Before discussing the economic outlook, I thought it might be useful to first explore some concepts that are very important in thinking about monetary policy. In particular, I wanted to spend some time today talking about the neutral rate of interest, which is a very important frame of reference. So what does that mean? Intuitively, I think of the nominal neutral interest rate as the level of the federal funds rate that would keep the economy's output growing at its potential rate and maintain full employment and inflation stable. Focusing on that neutral rate, there's a sort of shorter run concept of the neutral rate that, like the nation's economy, doesn't stay fixed but fluctuates when the overall demand in our economy fluctuates. So for instance, when we see legislation that increases the budget deficit through tax cuts and spending, that can generate tailwinds that propel demand stronger in the U.S. economy, and those would be expected to push up that shorter run neutral rate. When investors have an appetite for greater risk taking, that similarly can be expected to provide tailwinds to the economy and push up that shorter run neutral rate. And conversely, many of the forces that we saw contributing to the financial crisis, as well as declines in foreign demand for U.S. exports, could be expected to have the reverse effect. So in many circumstances, monetary policy can help keep the economy on that sustainable path simply by adjusting the policy rate to reflect movements in that shorter run neutral rate. And in those circumstances, the right way of assessing the stance of monetary policy is just to think about the gap between the policy rate or the federal funds rate and that nominal shorter run neutral rate. So much for the shorter run neutral rate. There's also a related concept that you may hear about, which is the longer run equilibrium rate. The longer run refers to the economy being at its longer run trend after tailwinds or headwinds have died down in an environment still of full employment and stable inflation. In fact, when FOMC participants, myself and the Reserve Bank presidents, other members of the board, write down their economic projections, which you see in the summary of economic projections, the only neutral rate that we report is that longer run equilibrium federal funds rate. But the shorter run neutral rate, rather than that longer run federal funds rate, is the relevant benchmark for assessing the near-term path of monetary policy whenever there are headwinds or tailwinds. So recent estimates suggest that that longer run equilibrium rate is much lower than it was in the decades before the crisis. Currently, it's in the range of about 2.5 to 3.5%. And in fact, the last time FOMC participants wrote down their projections, the median estimate was about 3%. By those estimates, the long-run neutral rate has fallen a lot. It used to be about 4 to 5% in earlier decades, and that perhaps reflects slower labor force growth and slower productivity. When we turn instead to the shorter-run neutral rate, estimates suggest that that is much more cyclical. It falls during recessions and it rises during expansions, and current estimates suggest that the current expansion is no exception. Last year, the unemployment rate returned to pre-crisis levels, and that outcome required interest rates that, after subtracting inflation, were actually below zero for 10 years. This year, the unemployment rate has continued to fall, and job market gains have actually gathered strength at the same time that the federal funds rate, the policy rate that the FOMC sets, has increased. That combination suggests that underlying shorter run neutral rate has increased. If instead that neutral rate had remained constant, we would have expected to see labor market gains actually slowing as the federal funds rate increased. And that intuition lines up with what we see from the models. It's also corroborated by the observation that if you look at financial conditions overall, taking into account equity valuations and other kinds of credit spreads, they've remained quite accommodative during a period when the federal funds rate has been increasing. So if you look at the latest projections from the FOMC, that median projection actually has the federal funds rate rising to a level that is in excess of the longer run equilibrium rate. At the same time, those projections see real GDP growth, output growth continuing to grow above potential, and unemployment continuing to fall. So why might that be? We can think about some specific factors that might be pushing that short-run neutral rate above its longer-run trend in the next few years. For one, the sizable fiscal stimulus in the pipeline could be expected to bolster tailwinds and that short-run neutral rate. The relatively rich level of current asset valuations relative to their historical levels is another factor that could push the short-run neutral rate above its longer-run value, even as it creates tailwinds in the economy. Corporate credit spreads are very narrow, and equity valuations are elevated relative to their historical levels, even after taking into account the relatively low level of interest rates. So having provided that context for how we think about policy, I want to now turn to some observations on the outlook. By any measures, overall national growth in the second quarter was strong. GDP increased at a 4.25% annual rate in real terms, which is a very rapid pace, 9 years into an expansion. Looking ahead, it looks likely that growth will remain solid. Confidence is high. Private domestic demand momentum among consumers and businesses is solid, and of course, fiscal stimulus will continue to work its way through the economy at least for the next year or two. The labor market's also strong. So far this year, payroll gains have averaged more than 200,000 per month, which is actually a step up from last year's pace and well above estimates of what would be needed to absorb new entrants into the labor force. The share of the prime age population, that part of the population that is considered by economists to be of working age, that's employed, has risen by almost a percentage point over the past year. And these developments are particularly heartening, suggesting that the tight labor market is, in fact, providing employment opportunities to a broader number of Americans. Even so, there might be some room for further employment gains because that number, that ratio, is still a bit below where it was pre-crisis. In another encouraging development, we saw wage gains in the most recent report reaching their highest level since the depths of the financial crisis, although wage growth is still relatively moderate by historical standards. While various measures of wages have actually accelerated over the past year, and we hear anecdotal evidence of shortages in some sectors and some regions, and many of you in the room may may actually be seeing that in some of your businesses. There isn't evidence of rapid acceleration in the aggregate measures of wages. At 3.9%, the August unemployment rate was down a half a percentage point over its previous year, and if it continues to decline at this rate, we'll soon see unemployment rates we haven't seen since the 1960s. Historically, the few periods when resource utilization has been at similarly high levels, we've tended to see elevated risks either of accelerating inflation or of financial imbalances. So far, the data on inflation remains encouraging. It provides little signal of an outbreak of inflation to the upside on the one hand, and some reassurance that underlying trend inflation may be moving closer to the target of the FOMC of 2% on the other. The FOMC's preferred measure of core inflation increased 2% over the past 12 months, which is consistent with that target. The last few times unemployment fell to levels as low as those projected over the next year, signs of overheating actually showed up in imbalances in the financial sector rather than in accelerating overall inflation. Our assessment, the Federal Reserve's assessment, suggests that, in fact, financial vulnerabilities are rising, which isn't surprising after a long period of expansion and very low interest rates. In the corporate sector in particular, low spreads and loosening credit terms are mirrored by rising debt levels among some corporations that could be vulnerable to downgrades in the event of adverse developments, and leverage lending is again on the rise. We're seeing spreads on leverage loans and the securitized products backed by those loans is relatively low, and underwriting standards may be declining to pre-crisis levels. While that tightening resource utilization and those financial conditions suggest some upside risks to the outlook, recent foreign developments suggest some downside risks. Trade policy, as you know, in this region has introduced uncertainty. Growth in Europe and Japan has moderated from the strong pace of last year, and political risks have reemerged in countries such as Italy. China is contending with deleveraging and some deceleration, as well as a challenging trade environment. As U.S. growth has pulled away from foreign growth, in part reflecting that fiscal policy divergence, expectations of monetary policy divergence strengthened, contributing to upward pressures on the dollar earlier this year. The resulting currency adjustments are compounding challenges faced by some emerging market economies, along with a complicated and unpredictable trade environment. Although capital flow reversals have been contained to several notably vulnerable countries so far, I'm attentive to a risk that a pullback from those emerging markets could broaden to others. So let me conclude by sketching out the implications for policy. Barring unexpected developments, continued gradual increases in the federal funds rate are likely to be appropriate to sustain full employment and inflation near its objective. With government stimulus providing tailwinds to demand over the next 2 years, it seems reasonable to expect the shorter run rate to rise somewhat higher than the longer run equilibrium rate. Farther out, the policy path will depend on how the economy evolves. Those developments raise the prospect that at some point, the committee's setting of the federal funds rate will exceed current estimates of that longer run federal funds rate. And in fact, as I noted, that's a property of the current projections in the summary of economic projections. That in turn raises the possibility of a flattening or inversion in the yield curve in the event that term premiums don't rise. Now, why are people attentive to that? Well, like many of you, I am attentive to the historical regularity that inversions of the yield curve, when short rates rise above long rates, between the 3-month and the 10-year treasury yields, have had a relatively reliable track record in preceding recessions here in the US. But what's different today, in contrast to those historical episodes, is that the current 10-year treasury yield is very low at around 3%. Well below the average of above 6% during the decades that those historical episodes took place. So one important reason that yield is very low is that what we call the term premium has fallen to levels that are extremely low by historical standards. According to one estimate, it has been slightly negative, in fact, until very recently, and is only slightly positive. By contrast, that term premium that was embedded in the longer run rate was 100 basis points, so 100 basis points of a much higher 10-year rate. When the spread between the 3-month and 10-year, which is what we refer to when we talk about the yield curve, was at its peak of 325 basis points in 2010. That suggests we may want to temper somewhat the conclusions we can draw from those historical episodes. In particular, if the term premium remains very low, any given amount of monetary policy tightening through the federal funds rate could lead to an inversion in that yield curve sooner, so that even a modest tightening, which wouldn't have led to any inversion in the past, could do so today. So why might we expect term premia to stay low? Because of course they could change, they could move up. But one important reason the term premium may be lower than in the past globally is that asset purchases of foreign central banks may continue to be weighing on that long end of the curve. If that is true, and if that starts to change as those asset purchase programs diminish, then we may, for the same reason, start to see the yield curve behaving more like what we would be accustomed to in the past. In any case, it's worth highlighting that the flattening yield curve suggested by that projection in the summary of economic projections is associated with a policy path that's chosen precisely to sustain full employment and inflation at target. So while I will keep a close watch on the yield curve as an important signal of financial conditions, it will be one among several considerations that inform my policy path. Indeed, the possibility that the policy path could have unintended consequences is precisely one of the most compelling reasons that we have been, and it's projected, we would continue to raise interest rates gradually. The gradual pace of interest rates gives us some time to assess the effect of our policies as we proceed. While the information we have available to us today suggests that a gradual path is appropriate, of course, we wouldn't hesitate to act decisively if things were to change. If, for example, underlying inflation were to move abruptly and unexpectedly higher, it might be appropriate to depart from that. Stable inflation expectations is one of the most important achievements of central banks in the past few decades, and we would defend it vigorously. So to summarize, our challenge now is to sustain full employment and inflation at 2%, which is likely to warrant continued gradual increases in the federal funds rate. With stimulus in the pipeline and financial conditions quite supportive, the shorter run neutral interest rate is likely to move up somewhat further, and it may well surpass that longer run equilibrium. Beyond the near term, how much further the neutral rate is likely to rise and whether it flattens or retreats somewhat in the future, those things are difficult to predict, and they're going to depend on a variety of developments, such as whether fiscal stimulus is extended or allowed to expire, whether foreign and trade risks grow or recede, and whether financial system vulnerabilities extend or recede. As such, the gradual pace of rate increases that is currently foreseen incorporates a degree of caution, which in my view is very appropriate. So let me finish there, and then I would be happy to take some questions on that or the economy more broadly.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Testing. We have some great questions here, many from the students from this morning, so it's been very difficult for me to glean through and pick some of the better ones, so I'll give it my best shot. What impact have you seen President Trump's tax cuts have in the short term, but more importantly, what long-term impact will they have?
So it's early days to be able to have enough data to be able to explicitly connect particular measures to the outcomes that we're seeing in the economy. What we do know from past episodes when we've had spending increases and tax cuts, and we're really having the combined effect of increased spending and tax cuts, we have tended to see a contribution to demand in the short run, and I was really referring to that a lot as a big consideration in terms of the tailwinds that are boosting aggregate demand. And of course, a lot of that stimulus is still in the pipeline. We'll only see it over the next few years. So we would expect from historical experiences that it would boost demand. Now, there's a question also, which I think your question was getting to, is how much will we actually see it boosting productivity and the supply side of the economy? And that is something that it would be very early to be able to assess right now. Again, these tax cuts and spending increases take place over a protracted period, and businesses are only now completely figuring out what those changes mean for them and deciding what that will mean in terms of how much of this will go to share buybacks, will there be any new investment that comes from this. We're seeing some of the share buybacks in the data, but I think it's too early to see how much it will lift the supply side of the economy.
An issue important to our region and really all regions, but what are your thoughts on how a trade war, if it comes about with certain country, may impact economic growth in the U.S.?
Yeah, so trade is a source of uncertainty right now. We have Reserve Bank boards and advisory councils all over the country in all of our 12 districts. And we also get surveys from an even broader sample of businesses through our Beige Book surveys. And the themes that we see in those Beige Books and in our discussions, I think, are ones that are very familiar to you, which is that for some particular sectors, they're seeing impacts of measures. So in some particular cases, there may be some trade actions that are actually changing prices and leading to some shortages. But we're really not seeing, it would be hard to say there's a discernible impact in the aggregate numbers overall, either in prices or in confidence, which, as I said earlier, is quite high. Obviously, if there were a much broader set of actions and a lot of counter reaction that spread more broadly, you know, one could expect to see it in some uncertainty, perhaps investment being postponed. We could see it in broader price measures, but I don't see any of that in the data today.
As you mentioned, as rates generally rise, are you concerned that, alongside of that, rising mortgage rates could slow down the economy?
Yeah, so obviously the way that that monetary policy transmission takes place is it works its way through the economy, and it shows up in the cost of credit to households and businesses slowly over time. Now, in terms of the housing sector, we have, in fact, seen some increase in mortgage rates, and that has been a very important sector in the economy generally. But in terms of overall demand, it's, you know, part of a much larger, very dynamic economy. And the housing sector itself, because of the boom and bust that we saw in the previous crisis, is coming back and, you know, has recovered, but is not as large a part of that incremental demand as you might have seen in previous recoveries. So obviously, you know, we've got a lot of young people who are looking to buy houses for the first time. There are questions about housing affordability more generally that go partly to credit, but they also go to supply conditions. And so I think more generally, yes, we're going to keep a close watch on housing affordability. That matters a lot. But I'm not seeing this as a major headwind on the expansion.
In this age of instant information, the Fed analyzes quite a bit of data in order to effectively implement monetary policy. How has technology and the efficiencies created by the use of technology had an impact?
Yeah, so it is, it's really, I think, noticeable in our work, and I know it is in all of the businesses that you're engaged in, the ability to process and access and analyze very large data sets in closer to real time is giving us kind of better snapshots into the state of the economy. So increasingly, our economists are trying to combine sources of data. For instance, we have loads of private sector reports on payrolls that come out with greater frequency than the BLS data. And so by combining data sources, we can often get a nearer time sense of what's going on in the labor market. So when the actual labor market data comes out, we have a richer picture. And I'm sure all of you are using data sets and using data analytics and maybe even machine learning and AI to be able to make sense and make decisions better with more real-time data. I anticipate that process is only going to broaden and accelerate, and you know, I think it will just give us a much more granular and high-frequency or real-time ability to take the pulse of the economy.
Even with the economy, as you mentioned, doing very well, is there any one action you feel could be taken now to even further stimulate economic growth across the country? And what might it be?
So, you know, my sense is that a lot of the challenges that we face economically as a nation are really outside the realm of monetary policy. We have a pretty clear-cut mandate from Congress. You know, we have a tool. And we're supposed to achieve maximum employment and price stability, which is defined as 2% inflation. So that's, we stay in our lane. But if you look across the country, education, skills development, workforce training, I've seen some programs even here in Detroit that are really phenomenal. And I think if we, as a nation, and again, this is not our wheelhouse, you know, really put a lot of energy into that, we could see dividends really for decades to come in terms of the vibrancy of our economy, but also the breadth of people that would be able to feel like they can really take part meaningfully in our growth.
Maybe a little controversial. Do you believe that China and the EU are currency manipulators, like some have argued?
So again, you know, where we sit at the Fed, that's not a determination that we have any responsibility for. That really sits over with the Treasury Department. What we do is take into account conditions in China and the Euro area and the EU more generally, because those are very large parts of the world economy and they matter for our economy. And of course, we do take into account currency movements because those too are important for thinking about financial conditions and how vibrant the export sector of our economy is, how vibrant we are in terms of our competitiveness internationally. So from where we sit, we really take into account economic vibrancy and growth, currency developments in other large markets as inputs into how we think about the U.S. economy. But in terms of what we focus on is really just our piece of the puzzle, which is to target maximum employment, and 2% inflation, using the monetary policy tools we have, and leaving to others some of those issues that are really well beyond what we have responsibility for.
As you work towards that goal, what do you feel concerns you the most, or what would be the biggest risk to the economy in the short term, and then maybe in the longer term?
Yeah, so one of the things that I think, you know, keeps us all a little uncomfortable at night is something that I'm sure, again, is a really big consideration for you as well, and that is, you know, cybersecurity. We have some really important responsibilities in terms of both supervising large financial institutions that themselves have to deploy a lot of resources on keeping their systems secure, but we also have some really important payment responsibilities, fiscal service responsibilities that our reserve banks undertake. And so probably the thing that we think of as being the most immediate risk that we need to be very attentive to is the resilience of our payment system, and not just for cyber events, but more generally for natural disasters.
We touched on this and the question came up. Is it a big issue that so many Board of Governors spots remain vacant? And do you see that changing anytime soon, getting a full board back?
Yeah, so, you know, when the board was first put together and the Reserve Bank president positions were created, you know, it was very important to Congress that we had this careful balance. You know, we're supposed to have seven voters in D.C., and then this was supposed to be balanced by the Reserve Bank presidents who would have rotating voting amongst them. Well, obviously, that balance has been really knocked off quite consistently for many years now, because I don't think we've seen more than five governors at any time in a long period of time. And most recently, we've been operating with three governors. Now, the truth is, we're a very collegial group. The FOMC is. We spend a lot of time sharing our different perspectives before we come to a kind of agreement on how to move forward on monetary policy and what to say in the statements, so it doesn't really matter. But where it does, I think, matter a bit is just in terms of the kinds of responsibilities that we have. We are a little thin, so we have, as I said earlier, you know, we're very, very engaged in overseeing some of the largest bank holding companies in the United States. And of course, that's really important, as we saw in the crisis, doing that well. We have responsibility for overseeing the payment system, and that too matters a lot. If it's all going well, most Americans aren't aware we're doing it. But if something goes wrong, it would become very noticeable very quickly. We also have responsibilities in terms of community reinvestment and making sure that banks are able to meet that obligation to invest in their communities. So that's why we have people all over the country talking to community development groups and businesses and banks. And we have international responsibilities because we want to know what other central banks, how they're setting their monetary policy, what are they doing with their big banks to make sure that we're coordinated. It's really hard to be, you know, in attending a meeting somewhere in the U.S. at the same time you're supposed to be in a meeting in an international forum. And so right now we're kind of scrambling. I'm hopeful. We have one more. We have the vice chair who's confirmed and coming on board, and then I'm hopeful we get those other slots filled soon.
Great. You grew up as an expatriate in communist Poland and Germany before the fall of the Berlin Wall. How do you think that impacts your worldview and you bring it into your work?
Yeah, so I think it was very impactful. You know, I saw examples of different economies and, you know, how well they were doing in terms of being able to fully kind of use the talents of their people, create opportunities, create kind of new ventures. And that experience of seeing some economies, Poland at the time, had a lot of red tape and a lot of central planning. I always tell the story that, you know, one day somebody somewhere in the capital would say, okay, it's red skirt season. And they would just churn out a bunch of red skirts, and the next day on the streets, everybody would be wearing the same outfit. And, you know, for a little girl, that was a pretty noticeable sign that something was wrong with that economic system. And, you know, people had good ideas, but they weren't able to get the capital or the go-ahead to create new businesses. And you see that transformation take place. So, you know, I've always been very attentive to how different economies function, how they provide for their populations, how much engagement there is, how much people's skills and talents are put to work. And of course, I always cared a lot also about how we deal with other countries, because I was an American living abroad, and so representing America was really important to me, and feeling proud about America's place in the world was also and continues to be very important to me.
Great. We're going to get to know you a little bit better now, so we have a new tradition here, the lightning round. So I'm just going
to
shoot out the question. First thing that jumps to your mind, let us know. Something on your bucket list.
Ooh, something on my bucket list. Get home in time to watch my daughter's soccer game.
That's good. That's good. A person you would like to have lunch with.
Oh, man. All right, I'll give you two. Are they allowed to be deceased?
Sure.
All right. Alexander Hamilton, who is, I think, a fascinating thinker and doer, and Frances Perkins, who was the first woman cabinet secretary and probably was responsible for a lot of Social Security and a variety of other programs. Most people don't even associate her with those things. So both of them.
Great. One of your favorite songs?
Creep by Radiohead.
Ah. Favorite team growing up?
Sorry?
Favorite team growing up?
Okay, so I was in Poland. You really want to ask that question? The Warsaw Warriors. No,
okay, we'll go with
that. I made
that
one up.
The last book you read?
So, that's a good question. So I have a stack of books by my bed. I'll give you the names of them really quickly. So I do love the Chernow book about Alexander Hamilton. And I do also like the David McCullough book about John Adams. And whenever I despair, I go back to reading about the founders and just remind myself just how incredible the founding of this nation was and the ideals that continue to motivate all of us today. But I also have Evicted by Matthew Desmond, Robert Putnam's book about our kids, and Hillbilly Elegy, just to remind myself in kind of, you know, sort of detail and personal stories, just the kinds of challenges we have as a nation, and to inspire us all to work to address them.
Great. Describe Detroit in one word.
Oh, America. This is America.
That's great. Close with us today by giving some advice to your 25-year-old self.
So, you know, I would say just be in the present more. Enjoy the ride. You know, my 25-year-old self was probably working in the Renaissance Center. You know, the Grand Prix used to take place right down below the Renaissance Center. And, you know, I was just so busy working that I'm not even sure I understood, you know, how great an opportunity this was to just go and enjoy being here in this incredible city. And I'd say that's true just generally. So enjoy the ride. Thank you.
I'm going to add Creep by Radiohead to my Spotify playlist and think of you. So Governor Brainerd, we're so honored that you chose us to deliver your Outlook speech, and good luck with the upcoming FOMC meeting. Thank you. Rich Schwabauer, thanks so much for your generosity to the DEC and for an outstanding job as presiding officer. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your time today. This meeting is now adjourned.